good question. Actually, that question comes oftentimes to test skepticism. Ordinary garden variety evil, for example, can be explained away, why somebody cheats on his taxes or why somebody doesn't do the normal courteous things in life that you'd like them to do, or somebody just comes and runs a key across your car. You know, you see that as irritants, upsetting, and in some ways maybe just, why on earth does a person think of these things? But then you move into enormous evil. And so the world sits back, stunned, when a man can take a sharp blade and behead a human being before the eyes of millions of people and think of himself as doing good. When you see extraordinary evil, you actually have to ask the question, is evil a real category in life? Or is evil also just a case of our construct for something that we cannot explain? So skeptics oftentimes will wrestle with issues like this. Do I have a legitimate beef against God when I say that I don't see any pattern or any good or any evil in this world? And yet there's a visceral response when he or she sees something so drastic. But then you have moved into the theist side of the question, and your question is, does there come a point at which stage you say, look, it is impossible for God to exist when I watch sometimes genocide and other issues are brought into the question? The interesting thing about the problem of evil, and I hail from the East, I will always be an Easterner in my thinking. When you read Eastern scriptures, when you're reading the Gita, or you're reading the Mahabharata, or you read all of the corpus of Sunni material, it's vastly anecdotal, almost entirely story after story after story. The entire Gita is a story of two brothers going to war against each other, and one asking the charioteer, who happens to be Krishna, but the Arjuna does know it's Krishna, asking him, how can I legitimize what I'm about to do? So your question has to be pushed back to every worldview. Does there come a point at which Islam has to explain it? Yes. Does there come a point at which pantheism has to explain it? Yes. Does there come a point at which Judeo-Christian theism has to explain it? And when you look at the Holy Scriptures for the Christian, and you see a man like Habakkuk saying, I have a question for you. Why do you tolerate so much wrong? Why do you cause me to look so much injustice? Why do you just sit back and let evil abound? That was Habakkuk's opening question to God. And they felt comfortable asking this of God. So the answer generally for the skeptic is in the trilemma. God is all powerful. God is all loving. Evil exists. That's an incoherent set of propositions. Therefore, something has to be given up, says the skeptic. He gives up the notion of God. But just take one of them at a time in order to answer this. Number one, if God is all powerful, why can't he also justify this world? Why can't he just say, I'm going to create a world such as this, I'm all powerful, I'm going to legitimize this, I'm going to say this is okay, I can create a world like this where evil and good exist, where choices are made. So what they really mean by all powerful is, why can't God create a world where we would only choose good? That's really what they are asking. And as Vince has implied, if love is the supreme ethic, choice is necessary. Where choice is possible, evil is a necessary response for the freedom of the will. So I look at it in these terms in trying to answer that question. G.K. Chesterton made two comments that I think give me the clue to moving on with this. Number one, he said, when belief in God becomes difficult, the tendency is to turn away from him, but in heaven's name do what? When belief in God becomes difficult, the tendency is to turn away from him, but in heaven's name to what? So my question for the person who looks at gross evil and says, do you stop believing in God at this point? I would say to him, what do you start believing at this point? What is the worldview that you feel comfortably allows you to coexist with this? That's the first thing. And then he went to, Chester went on to say, he said, God is like the sun. You cannot look at it, but without it, you cannot look at anything else. God is like the sun. You cannot look at it, but without it, you can't look at anything else. In the purview of God, whether it's little evil or gross evil, explanations are there by the grand design of what he has created in you and me for the supreme ethic of love, and has given to us the greatest gift possible, the freedom to choose and the freedom to reject. I put that on one side of it and then bring you to another perspective. It is this. If gross evil alone led me to question the existence of God, what do I do with the emptiness that comes from pleasure? Most people I know who are thoroughly empty and leading lives of total meaninglessness are those who have expended themselves in pleasure, spent themselves in pleasure, and they walk away from that saying, it is all a chasing after the wind. I was walking through the streets of Delhi, and I'll leave you with this and let Vince pick it up, because he moves so beautifully in the book through the notion of the cross and what that all means in this. I was born and raised in Delhi till I was 20 years old. And I used to go to a movie theater called the Regal Cinema. I never had any money to buy a ticket, but I had friends who could buy it for me. So I was going back through the streets a few years ago, and I just stood in front of that theater and brought back memories. It's been about 3-4 decades. My life had gone by since then. And I was watching how the beggars were navigating through the crowd. I grew up with that and never noticed it. Now I was coming with a counter perspective and said, this is incredible what I'm seeing. So the beggars are going around and you can't walk in and give something. You just draw a whole host of them. I watched one guy on a bit of a contraption, four wheels with a board, and one limb was gone, the right leg. The other one was so bandaged up with ugly stains of pus and blood all over it, and I think that also was more of a stump. And the arms looked rather mangled, but he was able to push himself along, just able to push himself along. There's a crowd out here. And I just watched him carefully till he could go away some distance, and I could do it rather covertly then. I went over towards him and I said, Bhai Saab, that means brother, sir. And I paused. And I took a 100-rupee note, which I had in me, which would have been a lot of money for him, which wasn't really very much for me. That would be about a little over a pound. And I just, maybe just a pound, it's 60 rupees to a dollar, and you can figure that out. So I just bent down, gave him that 100-rupee note. So it's a dollar and a half for me, 100 rupees for him. He looks like this, down to see what it is he's got in his hand. He can see it's a 100-rupee note. He clutches the hand and he looks at me and says, Saab Ji, respected sir, Bhagwan aapko bhala kare, may God richly bless you. To myself, a man with one leg and gnarled hands pushing himself, somebody must bring him every day. And the first thought that comes to his mind is to bless God. You see, here's the issue. You and I can take the same data and come to extensions that are very, very different. The worldview in the East does not see suffering as antithetical to belief in God. They see it as something that has to be explained and doesn't do away with the existence of God. In the Christian worldview, gross evil is explainable. In the pantheistic worldview, it's merely karma. And in the Islamic worldview, it's inshallah. It's just the will of God coming upon you in some fashion. Take the particulars of the Christian life, and I think it is much more explainable. And when the tendency is to turn away from God, what worldview do you really go to even explain the grossness of evil? That is my initial response to Mormon. Yes.
Just to add briefly, is there Could I imagine a world in which there is a type of evil and an extent of evil in which would make me question God? One way I would answer the question would be to say, if there was a world with gross evil, horrendous evil, and the supposed God never came to suffer alongside those he created in that world. That seems very significant to me. If, as a Christian, I'm going to claim that God is a loving parent, and God is referred to as a father hundreds of times in the Bible, 245, I think, in the New Testament, if that's going to be one of my claims, yes, a parent sometimes allows suffering in the life of a child, but the loving parent is willing to come and suffer alongside their children. Friedrich Nietzsche once wrote about this problem. He wrote, "The gods justified human life by living it themselves, the only satisfactory response to the problem of suffering ever invented." Nietzsche was writing about the ancient Greeks there. He never made the connection to Christianity. But as a Christian, I can agree with him and say, that's what I find at the cross of Jesus Christ. And if that was not part of my story, then I would think I would have to seriously question the goodness and the love of God in the context of a world that includes a lot of evil. But because he came and suffered alongside us, I believe I can continue to trust in his love and his goodness.
When you deal with it as a discipline, you have what you call the moral problem of evil. How does one actually justify morality, either in a theistic or a naturalistic framework? Then you have the metaphysical problem, why is it even possible? And then you come finally to the physical problem of evil, which is the question that you have raised. Why do natural disasters occur? We call them tragedies rather than atrocities. And that is always the harder question for the worldview, the Judeo-Christian worldview, or any other worldview to truly explain. If I can go back for just one moment. In the trilemma, God is all-powerful, God is all-loving, evil happens, that is an incoherent set of propositions, say the skeptic. All you need to do is add two more propositions which are also believed with equal firmness. Fourthly, God is all-wise. We believe God is all-wise. And fifthly, God dwells in eternity. So time is just one component of your existence and mine. If a child is given an injection at the age of 6 or 8 months and the parent has taken the child to the doctor and it's a stabbing pain and the child has no understanding what on earth is going on here, why did my mother place me on this table where this guy is coming with something sharp to jab into my arm? And then the years go by, time becomes the component of understanding. Why does that actually happen? Why even that pain was involved and yet it was for protection? And I say this, that when you see physical evil, when you see the floods, you see the tsunamis, you see the tragedies that occur, sometimes, not all the time, sometimes human agency has been responsible for some of these things. And those who call upon us to deal with the environment as stewards, as responsible people, are reminding us how important it is that these things actually be expressed. When it becomes purely a focus on the environment and no focus on the environment, that's when the imbalance comes and we no longer can understand this in the true balance that needs to have. So the first reality is the most evil that we see is deep within us, causes the evil to rise within us. In the scriptures, we are given the story that God created humanity with the freedom to choose and the freedom to enjoy. Now here's the thing. There was only one prohibition at creation, at the dawn of creation, one prohibition. Do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Because in the day that you eat of it, you know, that you become really as God, knowing good and evil. That one prohibition, over against all of the freedoms, made it so important for us to understand what God was actually saying. God was really saying, don't play God. Don't play God. Don't define good and evil yourself. Let God be God, and you and I understand the moral law. Now, millennia later, look at the world. Every tree is protected except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But we are free to define good and evil in any terms we want to, and the environment outside us is the only thing that we try to protect. We have no longer the way to define what it is that's going on inside. Within that choice, when we played God, the rupture began first with God, then with each other. For the first time, nakedness became a thing of shame rather than a thing of intimacy and the consummate relationship that man could have with the partner that God had given to him. Sexuality became an estrangement, shame came into it, the consummate act of love all of a sudden became a thing that could be used for wrong purposes. Along with that, all of creation was in the same situation of being fallen, so that man became almost an animosity with the creation. First with God, then with his fellow human being, and then with creation, the created order. And so what you and I see now is the physical reaction in the world itself. All the floods, all the calamities, and the physical problem of evil is at least explained in the created, in the creation story. It is not explained in any other worldview other than just to admit that men and women suffer at the hands of physical calamity. If the story of the creation is true, and the story of the fall is true, then the created order is precisely demonstrating what it is that the moral order represented when representing the physical universe, same as in the physical being in sickness and disease as well. You know, C.S. Lewis had a very simple statement when he said there are two kinds of beings in this world, those who have bent their knee to God, and God says to them, and they say to God, "Your will be done," or those who refuse to bend their knee to God, and God says to them, "Your will be done." Ultimately, it's the choice that you make in which heaven is a confirmation of the trust that you have placed in allowing God to be God. Heaven, so it was Dostoevsky who I think made a very strong comment when somebody asked him what he thought hell was like. And he said, it didn't matter to him what the elements would be in terms of pain and suffering. He said, to me, hell would be the inability to love. Hell would be the inability to love. And if heaven is the supreme example of what the love of God is all about and what the relationship with God is all about, you see, if you look at the pantheistic worldview, what is it they're aiming for? Union with the divine. That's why a true pantheist doesn't pray. A pantheist will meditate. It's a capital I. You look inwards. You are ultimately an expression of the impersonal power within the universe. A true skeptic, Bertrand Russell says, only upon a foundation of unyielding despair am I going to have built my life in this world. There's that permanent severance of life. You just cease to be. In the Christian worldview, it's communion with the living God. I gave the illustration yesterday of my father-in-law, who's an engineer and a very strong believer in evidence. And after 60-some years, did you need to make an announcement? I'm happy for you to do it. Right? He's going to come on anyway in a minute to do that. I didn't want to extend that time. Here he's in the mid-80s, goes through a traumatic time of 4 months, diagnosis of cancer, and then he's going to pass away within 4 months. And he's sitting with me and Tommy. He had 4 daughters, didn't have a son. And he would always treat me as a son he never had, and he would talk to me. Goes into silence for a few days. Body shriveled up. He'd ask a lot of questions. Although he was a committed Christian, had a lot of questions. In the background, hymns are playing, hymns that he loved. And all of a sudden, he opens his eyes and his mouth for just one moment. He makes two statements, just two statements. And what he'd said to me earlier was, you know, I don't think I provided for Mama. I said to him, Dad, you have provided, but even if you hadn't, why don't you allow us to take care of her? We'll do it. And he looked at me and he said, son, it was my duty my duty to take care of her. I said, Dad, you have taken care of her. And I assured him from talking to his accountant and all of that. So my man was World War II veteran. Opens his mouth, looks towards the heavens, and these are the two statements he makes. Amazing. Just amazing. And he looked at his wife of 63 years and he says, Jean, I love you. And he was gone. That farewell of a man who'd done his duty before God out of love and to his family, heaven is going to be a confirmation of that which you placed your trust in. And at that moment, the freedom to love to the fullest is bestowed upon you, unhindered by sin. And that's why the Bible says there is no temple there, there are no tears there, there is no intermediary, there is no brokenness. It is you in communion with the living God. So freedom confirmed for perpetual novelty is the gift that God gives to those who trust Him. Those who refuse to trust Him end up in a world bereft of love because they rob themselves of the very love of God and the love of a human being that hung on the greatest commandment. That's my thought for you. Heaven gives you freedom to perpetual novelty is the phrase that I use.
I mean, sometimes we think that parameters around relationships means that we're less free. And I like to think of this in part in terms of my marriage, my relationship with my wife. You know, there are certain parameters around our relationship now that we didn't have previously. I don't think that has to be something that restricts my freedom. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, one of those parameters is that we sort of made a decision together that we're not going to get divorced. One of the parameters is we made a decision together that we're not going to be romantic or have sexual relations with anyone else. You could see that as a restriction of freedom, but actually it seems to me that that's part of us having the freedom to live in the fullness of relationship that we were designed for. And I think of heaven like that. Yes, there are going to be certain parameters about whether or not we can do certain things, but actually those parameters will only be parameters in the context of God framing the relationship in which we were most designed to live in and in which we're going to delight in and in which we're going to enjoy. And that relationship is going to be meaningful and free precisely because, as Robbie was saying, there was a time such as this in which we had the full freedom to choose that and not to choose something different. I think God can give us a variety of good things. Sometimes we put the good things together in the wrong way and it turns into something evil. I think God giving me a free will, just the ability to choose between options, that's a good thing. I can make meaningful choices as a result of it. God giving me the power to be able to move my arm, that's a good thing as well. I can serve people in that way. I can help people in that way. I can touch someone in a caring way with that power. But if God gives me those two things, if He gives me a genuinely free will and He gives me the power to move my arm, then I have the ability to move it in a way that wouldn't be very loving either and could cause evil and could cause suffering. So I don't think we need to say that God is in any way the origin of evil. He gives us all good things. But sometimes when we put those good things together in the wrong way, then they create suffering. An analogy that I find really helpful is the analogy of procreation. Of parents having a child. Part of your question is the idea that, look, God created Adam and Eve. He put them in the environment. Surely He knew that suffering was going to come as a result. So isn't He, therefore, the cause or to blame? That's a really reasonable challenge. I think an analogy with having children helps. If parents decide to have a child, they're doing something that they know full well will result in serious suffering. Even the most fortunate of human lives includes serious suffering. And actually, it's a really difficult thought, but actually, any child that comes to exist will one day actually suffer death.
And yet, we don't think that having a child is necessarily an evil thing to do. In fact, we think it could be a loving thing to do. It could even be a courageous thing to do. My point is this. If we think that it is in principle immoral to create people in an environment in which we know they are going to suffer seriously, we will not only need to call God evil, we will also need to call evil anyone who decides to have a child. And that doesn't seem right to me. So it seems to me that when we think about a creator creating beings in an environment where he knows there will be suffering, that can't in and of itself mean that the creator is evil. Whether or not he's evil or good has to do more with, is he willing to suffer alongside those he created? Is he willing to be committed to eventually defeating that suffering so that one day there could be a place, as the Bible says, where God will wipe every tear from our eyes, where there'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain? Is he committed to suffering alongside us in that way and to ultimately see us through the suffering? It seems to me that's the way we assess whether or not a parent is loving, both a human parent and I think also how we should think about a divine parent.
There's a mystery that is legitimate, and there are mysteries when you try to unpack too much of it, you begin to shake under the weight of what is truly intended to be that beyond which mind cannot ultimately cross. I want to lead into a point through this. When I look at Jesus, God incarnate, I was not raised with any of this stuff. And I was sort of staggering under the weight of trying to come to terms with all of these things when the Bible was brought to me. My commitment to Christ came when I was 17 years old in New Delhi, and I'd attempted to take my own life, and the Bible was brought to me. I never opened a Bible myself before, and even this one I couldn't hold it because my body was dehydrated from the poison I'd taken and all the moisture was gone. My mother had to hold it and read it for me. The paradigm shift was beginning at that time, the ultimate paradigm shift. And counterintuitively, I reacted to some things the way maybe a Westerner would react. For example, when Jesus was asked, "When will you be returning? What is the time of your coming?" I was stunned by the fact that Jesus said, "Of that hour no man knows, not even the Son of Man." To me, that was such an incredible response because it was so authentic. If he were fake, if he were a charlatan, you know what his answer would have been? "I know, but I'm not going to tell you." That's all he would need to have said. "Why do you need to know? That's only for me to know." And so he stuns his audience by saying, "It's not that hour, no man knows, not even the Son of Man." Then you come to another moment where he is in this Garden of Gethsemane struggling, and he didn't want to go the way of the cross. And the weight of the cross to him was not just so much physical as much as the very agony of the horrific nature of sin. And then he says, "If there is any other way, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." And he goes all the way to Calvary. And when he goes to Calvary, and that the weight of sin falls off the pilgrim, that's symbolized by what actually happened at Calvary. Now here's what I want to say to you. Another point that he made before he went there was that when you kill me and take my life, I will bodily rise again. There's another thing that shook me. I thought if he were fake, he would have said, "I'm spiritually going to rise again." How do you falsify that? After the resurrection, you'd have just said, "Yeah, he said he was spiritually going to rise again, you know, so maybe here's the body, but he's..." These are the components that tell me how genuine, authentic this whole thing was. And so was his physical suffering. So was the agony to represent to you and me that sin is actually brokenness. Sin is brokenness. The sin that you and I get into, and I've been there, believe me, it shattered me on the inside. It broke me on the inside. Attempting to be free, I was moving myself into chains. And what I found in my commitment to Jesus Christ, that he changed not only what I did, he changed what I wanted to do. And the suffering servant that the Bible talks about tells you and me the grievous nature of what sin actually is and how shattering it is to the body and the physical ailments of it. I think what Jesus did was endure that suffering, and in that moment where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? That momentary separation of even the Trinity was the ultimate pain within him. And once he rises again and the resurrection story is seen and the resurrection story is told, Saul of Tarsus is then told that he was going to be a voice to the Gentiles in his conversion. And he said, but you will also suffer much for my name's sake. And that's why he said that I may know him, the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his suffering, being made conformable unto his death. God incarnate endured the suffering and endured the pain. I don't think it's a contradiction in terms. And there is one illustration I'll give you, and then let Vince close it up here. See, language, Aquinas says, comes in three ways: univocal, equivocal, and illogical. Univocal, when two words in different sentences mean the same thing. Equivocal, when two words in different sentences, or maybe the same word, but they do not mean the same thing. If you were to ask Andy Murray, are you a good tennis player? And he says yes. And you were to ask me, are you a good tennis player? And I say yes. You'd be making the biggest blunder of your life thinking I could get on the same court with Andy Murray. I couldn't see the ball going past me, leave alone trying to receive it. Use the word good. I use the word good. I'm using it in my context. He's using it at the supreme level of what tennis prowess is all about. It's an equivocal use of the term. When you come to God, we can't use it univocally. He's infinite. Using it equivocally, you don't actually get the full meaning. So what do? We use it analogically. When God says, I love you, and you refuse to love him, God hurts. When I say I love you, and you refuse to love me, I hurt. I hurt because I have lost something. God hurts because you have lost something. That's the difference. When God says he loves you and you refuse to love him, he says, my heart is grieved because you have lost something in the process. The love of God and the grieving of God, they are not contradictory terms. They are the fullest expression of who God is in his love for you and his love for me. It's a unique term, not found in any other place. The Gita says we need a sacrifice. We need a sacrifice, Krishna tells Arjuna. But the Gita ends without a sacrifice. It is only when you come to the gospel story and see the story of Calvary that you find out the love of God and the brokenness of Christ in the process of expressing his love for you and for me.